happened to do that. Thank the good Lord for that. Collegial rule brings out the coward in everyone, and Brezhnev just doesn't have the ability to lead. From what I hear, they have to walk into the men's room. It was a slight exaggeration, but it appealed to Ritter that Soviet leadership was softening. What's Cardinal telling us? Moore referred to the agency's premier agent in place in the Kremlin, the personal assistant to Defense Minister Dmitry Fedorovich Ustinov. His name was Mikhail Semyonovich Filatov, but to all but a bare handful of active CIA personnel, he was simply Cardinal. He says that Ustinov despairs of anything useful coming out of the Politburo until they do have a leader who can actually lead. Leonid is slowing down. Everybody knows it, even the man on the street. You can't camouflage a TV picture, can you? How long do you suppose he has left? A collection of shrugs, then Greer took the question. The doctors I've talked to say he could drop over tomorrow, or he could dote along for another couple of years. They say they see mild Alzheimer's, but only mild. His general condition is progressive cardiovascular myopathy, they think, probably exacerbated by incipient alcoholism. They all have that problem, Ritter observed. Cardinal confirms the heart problem, by the way, along with the vodka. And the liver is important, and his is probably suboptimum, Greer went on, with a gross understatement. Then Moore finished the thought. But you can't tell a Russian to stop drinking any more than you can tell a grizzly bear not to shit in the woods. You know, if anything ever brings these guys down, it will be their inability to handle the orderly transition of power. Well, gee, Your Honor. Bob Ritter looked up with a wicked grin. I guess they just don't have enough lawyers. Maybe we could ship them 100,000 of ours. They're not that stupid. Better we shoot a few Poseidon missiles at them. Less net damage to their society, the DDI said. Why do people disparage my honorable profession? Moore asked the ceiling. If anybody saves their system, it will have to be a lawyer, gentlemen. You think so, Arthur? Greer asked. You can't have a rational society without the rule of law. And you can't have the rule of law without lawyers to administer it. Moore was the former chief judge of the Texas State Court of Appeals. They don't have those rules yet, not when the Politburo can reach out and execute anyone they don't like without a semblance of an appeals process. It must be like living in hell. You can't depend on anything. It's like Rome under Caligula. If he got a notion, that notion had the force of law. Hell, though, even Rome had some laws the emperors had to abide by. Not our Russian friends. The others couldn't really appreciate how horrid a concept that was to their director. He'd once been the finest trial lawyer in a state noted for the quality of its legal community, and then a learned judge on a bench replete with thoughtful, fair men. Most Americans were as accustomed to the rule of law as to the 90 feet between bases on a baseball diamond. For Ritter and Greer, it was more important that, before his legal career, Arthur Moore had been a superior field spook. So what the hell do I tell the president? The truth, Arthur, Greer suggested. We don't know because they don't know. That was the only truthful and rational thing he could say, of course, but damn it, Jim, they pay us to know. It comes down to how threatened the Russians feel. Poland is just a cat's paw for them, a vassal state that jumps when they say jump, Greer said. The Russians can control what their own people see on TV and in Pravda, but they can't control the rumors that come across the border, said Ritter. And the stories their soldiers tell when they come home from service there. And in Germany, and in Czechoslovakia, and in Hungary. And what they hear on Voice of America and Radio Free Europe. CIA controlled the first of those outlets directly, and while the other was theoretically almost independent, that was a fiction nobody believed. Ritter himself had a great deal of input on both propaganda arms of the American government. The Russians understood and respected good agitprop. "How squeezed do you suppose they feel?" Moore wondered aloud. "Just 2 or 3 years ago, they thought they were on the crest of the wave," Greer announced. "Our economy was in the toilet with inflation, and we had gas lines, the Iran mess. They'd just got Nicaragua to drop into their lap. Our national morale was bad, and..." "Well, that's changing, thank God," Moore went on for him. "Full reversal?" he asked. It was too much to hope for, but at heart, Arthur Moore was an optimist. Otherwise, how could he be DCI? "We're heading that way, Arthur," Ritter said. "They're slow to catch on. They are not the most agile of thinkers. That's their greatest weakness. The top dogs are wedded to their ideology to the point that they can't see around it. You know, we can hurt these bastards. Hurt 'em bad, if we can analyze their weaknesses thoroughly and come up with a way to exploit them." "You really think so, Bob?" the DDI asked.
"I don't think it. I damn well know it," the DDO shot back.
"They are vulnerable, and best of all, they don't yet know that they are vulnerable. It's time to do something. We've got a president now who will back our play if we can come up with something good enough for him to invest his political capital. Congress is so afraid of him, they won't stand in the way."
"Robert," the DCI said, "it sounds to me like you've got something rattling up your sleeve."
Ritter thought for a few seconds before going on.
"Yes, Arthur, I do. I've been thinking about this since they brought me in from the field 11 years ago. I haven't written a single word of it down."
He didn't have to explain why. Congress could subpoena any piece of paper in the building. Well, almost any piece, but not something carried only in a man's mind. But perhaps this was the time to set it down. "What is the Soviets' fondest wish?"
"To bring us down," Moore answered.
That didn't exactly require a Nobel-class intellect.
"Okay, what is our fondest wish?"
Greer took that one.
"We aren't allowed to think in those terms. We want to find a modus vivendi with them."
That was what the New York Times said anyway, and wasn't that the voice of the nation?
"Okay, Bob, spit it out." "How do we attack them?" Ritter asked. "And by that I mean nail the bastards right where they live. Hurt them."
"Bring them down?" Moore asked.
"Why the hell not?" Ritter demanded.
"Is it possible?" the DCI asked, interested that Ritter was thinking along such lines.
"Well, Arthur, if they can aim that big a gun at us, why can't we do it to them?"
Ritter had the bit in his teeth now.
"They send money into political groups in our country to try and make it hard on our political process. They have anti-nuclear demonstrations all across Europe, calling to eliminate our theater nuclear weapons while they rebuild theirs. We can't even leak what we know about that to the media."
"And if we did, the media wouldn't print it," Moore observed. "After all, the media didn't like nuclear weapons either, though it was willing to tolerate Soviet weapons because they, for one reason or another, were not destabilizing." What Ritter really wanted to do, he feared, was to see if the Soviets had influence on the American mass media. But even if it did, such an investigation would bear only poisoned fruit. The media held on to its vision of its integrity and balance as a miser held his hoard. But they knew without having the evidence that KGB did have some power over the American media, because it was so easy to establish and exercise. Flatter them, let them in on supposed secrets, and then become a trusted source. But did the Soviets know how dangerous a game that could be? The American news media did have a few core beliefs, and tampering with them was like tinkering with a live bomb. One wrong move could be expensive. No one in this seventh-floor office was under much illusion about the genius of the Russian intelligence service. It had skilled people, certainly, and trained them thoroughly and well, but KGB also had its weaknesses, like the society it served. KGB applied a political template to reality and largely ignored the information that didn't match up with the halls. And so, after months, even years of painstaking planning and preparation, they often had operations go bad because one of their officers had decided that life in the land of the enemy wasn't quite so bad as it was portrayed. The cure for a lie was always the truth. It just had a way of smacking you in the face, and the smarter you were, the worse it hurt. "That's not important," Ritter said, surprising both his colleagues. "Okay. Keep going," Moore ordered. "What we need to do is examine their vulnerabilities and attack them, with the objective of destabilizing their entire country." "That's a very tall order, Robert," Moore observed. "You take an ambition pill, Bob?" Greer asked, intrigued even so. "Our political masters will blanch at that large an objective." "Oh, I know." Ritter held up his hands. "Oh, no, we mustn't hurt them. They might nuke us." "Come on, they're a hell of a lot less likely to lash out than we are. People, they are afraid of us, a lot more than we are of them. They are afraid of Poland, for Christ's sake. Why? Because there's a disease in Poland that their own people might catch. It's called rising expectations, and rising expectations are the one thing they can't satisfy. Their economy is as stagnant as stump water. If we give them a little push..." "All we have to do is kick in the door and the whole rotten structure will collapse," Moore quoted. "That's been said before, but Adolf had himself a nasty little surprise when the snow started falling." "He was an idiot who didn't read his Machiavelli," Ritter retorted. "First you conquer him, then you murder him. Why give them warning?" "Whereas our current adversaries could have taught old Niccolo a lesson or two," Greer agreed. "Okay, Bob, exactly what do you propose?" "A systematic examination of Soviet weaknesses with an eye to exploitation. In simplest terms, we investigate the possible shape of a plan to cause great discomfort to our enemy." "Hell, we ought to be doing that all the time anyway," Moore said, agreeing at once with the concept. "James?" "I have no problem with it. I can get a team together in my shop to toss some ideas together." "Not the usual suspects," the DDO urged. "We'll never get anything useful from the regular crew. It's time to think way the hell outside the usual box." Greer thought about that for a moment, then nodded agreement. "Okay, I'll do the picking. Special project. Pick a name for it?" "How about infection?" Ritter asked. "And if it turns into an operation, call it plague?" the DDI asked with a laugh. Moore shared in the chuckle. "No, I've got it. Mask of the Red Death. Something from Poe sounds about right to me. This is really about having the DO take over the DI, isn't it?" Greer thought aloud. It wasn't a serious undertaking yet. Just an interesting academic exercise. The same way a corporate trader might look into the fundamental strengths and weaknesses of a company he might want to take over. And then, if the circumstances justified, break it up for parts. No. The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics was the center of their professional world, the Bobby Lee to their Army of the Potomac,
the New York Yankees to their Boston Red Sox. Defeating them, however attractive a dream it might be, was little more than that, a dream. Even so, Judge Arthur Moore approved of that sort of thinking. If man's reach didn't exceed his grasp, then what the hell was heaven for? Approaching 23 hours in Moscow, Andropov was enjoying a cigarette, an American Marlboro, in fact, and sipping at his vodka, the premium Starka brand, which was brown like American bourbon. On the record player was another American product, an LP of Louis Armstrong on the trumpet, blowing some superb New Orleans jazz. Like many Russians, the chairman of the KGB regarded blacks as little more than monkey cannibals, but the ones in America had invented their own fine art form. He knew that he ought to have been a devotee of Borodin or one of the other classical Russian composers, but there was just something about the vitality of American jazz that rang some sort of bell in his mind. But the music was merely an aid for thinking. Yuri Vladimirovich Andropov had heavy brows over his brown eyes and a lantern jaw suggestive of another ethnic origin. But his mind was entirely Russian, which meant part Byzantine, part Tartar, part Mongol, and all focused on achieving his own goals. Of these, he had many, but above all, he wanted to be the leader of his country. Someone had to save it, and he knew exactly how much it needed saving. One of the advantages of being chairman of the Committee for State Security was that few things were secret from him, and this in a society that was replete with lies, where lies were indeed the highest of art forms. This was especially true of the Soviet economy. The command-driven structure of that flaccid colossus meant that every factory and every factory manager had a production goal that both it and he had to meet. The goals might or might not be realistic. That didn't matter. What did matter was that their enforcement was draconian. Not as draconian as they'd once been, of course. In the 1930s and 40s, failure to meet the goal set forth in the plan could mean death right here in this very building, because those who failed to meet the plan were wreckers, saboteurs, enemies of the state, traitors in a nation where state treason was a crime worse than any other, and so demanded a penalty worse than any other, usually a .44 caliber bullet from one of the old Smith & Wesson revolvers the Tsars had purchased from America. As a result, factory managers had learned that if they couldn't meet the plan's expectations in fact, they'd do so on paper, thus prolonging both their lives and the perks of their office. The facts of their failure were usually lost in the elephantine bureaucracy that had been inherited from the Tsars and then nurtured to further growth under Marxism-Leninism. His own agency had a lot of that same tendency, Andropov knew. He could say something, even thunder out the words, but that didn't mean that any real result had to happen. Sometimes it did. Indeed, fairly often of late, because Yuri Vladimirovich kept his own personal notes and would follow up a week or so later. And gradually, his agency was learning to change. But there was no changing the fact that obfuscation was the foil of even his brand of ruthlessness. Even Stalin reborn could not change that, and nobody wanted Stalin reborn. Institutional obfuscation had reached all the way to the summit of the party hierarchy. The Politburo was no more decisive than the management staff of State Farm Sunrise. No one had learned efficiency, he'd observed on his climb to the top of the heap, and as a result a great deal happened with a wink and a nod, with an understanding that it really wasn't all that important. And because so little progress actually happened, it devolved on him and the KGB to make right all the things that went wrong. If the organs of the state could not come up with what the state needed, then KGB had to go steal it from those who did have it. Andropov's spy agency
and its sister service, the military's GRU, stole all manner of weapons designs from the West. They were so efficient, he thought with a grunt, that Soviet pilots occasionally died from the same design defects that had killed American pilots years before. And that was the rub. However efficient KGB was, its most stirring successes merely guaranteed that his country's military was 5 years behind the West at best. And the one thing he and his field officers couldn't steal from the West was the quality control in their industries that made advanced weapons possible. How many times, he wondered, had his people secured designs from America and elsewhere, only to learn that his country simply could not replicate them? And that was what he had to fix. The mythical tasks of Hercules seemed trivial in comparison, Andropov told himself, stubbing out his cigarette. Transform his nation? In Red Square, they kept the mummy of Lenin as some sort of communistic god, the relic of the man who had transformed Russia from a backward monarchic state into a backward socialist state. The Moscow government expressed contempt for any countries that tried to combine socialism with capitalism, except for one little thing. KGB tried to steal from them, too. The West rarely shed blood and treasure to find out about Soviet weapons, except to find out what was wrong with them. The Western intelligence services did their best to frighten their parent governments, proclaiming every new Soviet weapon to be Satan's own tool of destruction. But then they later found out that the Soviet tiger wore lead boots and couldn't catch the deer, however frightening the tiger's teeth might appear. Whatever original ideas Russian scientists did come up with, and there were many of them, were duly stolen and converted by the West into instruments that actually worked. The design bureaus made their promises to the military and to the Politburo. They told them how their new systems would improve with just a little more funding. Ha! And all the time, this new American president was doing what his predecessors hadn't. He was feeding his tiger. The American industrial monster was eating raw red meat and actually manufacturing in numbers the weapons they'd developed over the preceding decade. His field officers and their agents reported that morale in the American military was rising for the first time in a generation. Their army in particular was training on increased tempos and their new weapons. Not that the Politburo believed him when he told them. Its members were too insular. They were unexposed to the real world beyond the Soviet frontiers. They assumed that all the world was more or less like it was here, in accord with the political theories of Lenin, written 60 years ago, as if the world hadn't changed at all since then, Yuri Vladimirovich raged silently. He expended enormous funds to find out what was happening in the world, had the data run through exquisitely trained and qualified experts, presented superbly organized reports to the old men who sat around that oaken table, and still they didn't listen. And then there was the current problem. This is how it will start, Andropov told himself, with another long sip of his Starka. It takes only one person, if it's the right person. Being the right person meant that people listened, paid attention to his words and deeds. And some people just got that sort of attention. And those were the ones you had to be afraid of. Carol, Carol, why must you make such trouble? And trouble it would be if he took the action he threatened. The letter he'd sent to Warsaw hadn't been just for those lackeys in Warsaw. He had to have known where it would end up. He was no fool. In fact, he was as shrewd as any political figure Yuri had ever known. You couldn't be a Catholic clergyman in a communist country and rise to the very pinnacle of the world's largest church to be their general secretary, even, without knowing how to operate the levers of power. But his post went back nearly 2,000 years, if you happen to believe all that nonsense. Well, maybe so. The age of the Roman Church was an objective fact, wasn't it? Historical facts were historical facts. But that didn't make the belief structure underneath it any more valid than Marx said it was. Or wasn't, to be more precise. Yuri Vladimirovich had never considered belief in God to make any more sense than belief in Marx and Engels. But he knew that everyone had to believe in something, not because it was true, but because it, in itself, was a source of power. Lesser people, the ones who needed to be told what to do, had to believe in something larger than themselves. Primitives living in the remaining jungles of the world still heard in the thunder, not just the clash of hot air and cold, but the voice of some living thing. Why? Because they knew they were weaklings in a strong world, and they thought they could influence whatever deity controlled them with slaughtered pigs, or even slaughtered children. And those who controlled that influence then acquired the power to shape their society. Power was its own currency. Some great men used it to gain comforts, or women. One of his own predecessors here at KGB had used it to get women, actually young girls. But Yuri Vladimirovich did not share that particular vice. No. Power was enough in and of itself. A man could bask in it as a cat warmed itself by a fire, with the simple enjoyment that came from having it close by, knowing that he enjoyed the ability to rule others, to bring death or comfort to those who served him, who pleased him with their obeisance and their fawning acknowledgement that he was greater than they. There was more to it, of course. You had to do something with that power. You had to leave footprints in the sands of time. Good or bad, it didn't matter. Just so they were large enough to command notice. In his case, a whole country needed his direction because of all the men on the Politburo. Only he could see what needed to be done. Only he could chart the course his nation needed to follow. And if he did it right, then he would be remembered. He knew that someday his life would end. In Andropov's case, it was a liver ailment. He ought not to drink his vodka, but with power also came the absolute right to choose his own path. No other man could tell him what to do. His latent intelligence knew that this was not always the wise thing to do, but great men did not listen to lesser men, and he considered himself the foremost of the former. Was not his force of will strong enough to define the world in which he lived? Of course it was. And so he had the occasional drink or two, or sometimes three, in the evening. Even more at official dinners. His country had long since passed beyond the point of rule by a single man. That had ended 30 years before with the passing of Kolba, Joseph Vissarionovich Stalin, who'd ruled with a ruthlessness to make Ivan the Terrible quake in his boots. No, that sort of power was too dangerous to ruler and ruled. Stalin had made as many errors as good judgments, and as useful as the latter had been, the former had very nearly doomed the Soviet Union to perpetual backwardness, and in fact, by creating the world's most formidable bureaucracy, he'd largely forsworn progress for his nation. But one man, the right man, could lead and direct his political associates on the Politburo in the correct direction. and then, by helping to select the new members, could accomplish the needed goals by influence rather than by terror. Just maybe, then, he could get his country moving again, keeping the single control that all nations needed, but adding the flexibility that they needed just as much for new things to happen. To achieve the true communism, to see the radiant future that the writings of Lenin proclaimed awaited the faithful. Andropov did not quite see the contradiction in his own mind. Like so many great men, he was blind to those things that conflicted with his own capacious ego. And in any case, it all came back to Carol and the danger he posed. He made a mental note for the morning staff meeting. He had to see what the possibilities were. The Politburo would wonder aloud how to deal with the problem announced by the Warsaw letter, and eyes would turn to his chair, and he'd need something to say. The trick would be in finding something which would not frighten his colleagues out of their conservative wits. They were so fearful, these supposedly powerful men. He read so many reports from his field officers, the talented spies of the first chief directorate, always probing into the thoughts of their counterparts. It was so strange how much fear there was in the world, and the most fearful of all were so often those who held the power in their hands. No. Andropov drained his glass and decided against another nightcap. The reason for their fear was they worried they did not have the power. They were not strong. They were henpecked by their wives, just like factory workers and peasant farmers. They dreaded losing what they so greedily held, and so they used their power in ignoble enterprises directed at crushing those who would seize what they held. Even Stalin, that mightiest of despots, had used his power mainly to eliminate those who might sit in his elevated chair. And so the great Koba had spent his energy not looking forward, not looking outward, but looking down. He was like a woman in her kitchen who feared mice under her skirt, instead of a man with the power and the will to slay an onrushing tiger. But could he do otherwise? Yes. Yes, he could look forward and see the future and chart a path to it. Yes, he could communicate his vision to the lesser men who sat around the table in the Kremlin and lead them with the force of his will. Yes, he could find and refocus the vision of Lenin and all the thinkers of the governing philosophy of his country. Yes, he could alter the course of his nation and be forever remembered as a great man. But first, here and now, he'd need to deal with Carol and his annoying threat to the Soviet Union. Chapter 2. Visions and Horizons. Kathy almost panicked at the thought of driving him to the train station. Seeing him walk to the left side of the car, she'd assumed, as any American would, that he'd be driving. And so she was visibly surprised when he tossed her the keys. The pedals, she discovered, were the same as in an American car, because people all around the world were right-footed, even if those in England drove left-handed. The gear shift was in the center console, and so she had to use her left hand to shift. Backing out of the brick driveway was not terribly different from normal. Both instantly wondered if it was as hard for Brits to transform their driving to the right, in more ways than one, side of the road when they came to America, or hopped the ferry to France. Jack decided he'd ask somebody over a beer someday. Just remember, left is right, and right is left, and you drive on the wrong side of the road. Okay, she replied with annoyance. She knew she'd have to learn, and the rational part of her brain knew that this was as good a time as ever, even though now had a nasty way of appearing out of the ground like a gorilla out of a spider hole. The way out of the mini-development took them past a one-story building that looked like it housed a doctor's office, past the park with the swing set that had sold Jack on this particular house. Sally liked swings, and she'd surely meet and make new friends here. And little Jack would get some sun there, too. In the summer, anyway. Turn left, babe. It's a right turn here when you go left. You don't cross traffic. I know, Dr. Carolyn Ryan said, wondering why Jack hadn't called for a cab. She still had a ton of work to do with the house and didn't need a driving lesson. Well, at least it seemed to be a nimble car, she found, giving it a kick that was answered by rapid acceleration. Not her old Porsche, though. Bottom of the hill, turn right. Uh-huh. Good. This would be simple. She'd have to find her way home, and she hated asking for directions. It came from being a surgeon, as in command of her world as a fighter pilot in his cockpit. And being a surgeon, she wasn't allowed to panic, was she? Right here, Jack told her. Remember oncoming traffic. There was none at the moment, but that would change, probably as soon as he got out of the car. He didn't envy her attempt to learn local navigation solo, but the surest way to learn to swim was to jump in. Assuming you didn't drown. But the Brits were hospitable of people, and if necessary, some kind local driver would probably lead her all the way home. The train station was about as impressive as a Bronx elevated platform. A smallish stone building with stairs and/or escalators that led down to the tracks. Ryan bought his ticket with cash, but noted a sign that offered books of commuter tickets for daily use. He picked up a copy of the Daily Telegraph. That would mark him to the locals as a conservative sort of person. Those of a more liberal bent chose the Guardian. He decided to pass on the tabloids that had naked women on the inside. Hell of a thing to see right after breakfast. He had to wait about 10 minutes for the train, which arrived with little noise, being a cross between an American Electric intercity train and a subway. His ticket was first class, which placed him in a small compartment. The windows went up and down if you pulled on a leather strap, and the compartment door hinged outward to let him exit directly instead of walking down the corridor. With that set of discoveries made, Ryan sat down and scanned the paper's front page. As in America, local politics covered about half of the sheet, and Ryan looked at two of the articles, figuring he might as well learn the local customs and beefs. The schedule said about 40 minutes to Victoria Station. Not too bad, and much better than driving it, Dan Murray had told him. In addition, parking a car in London was even worse than it was in New York. Wrong side of the street and all. The ride on the train was agreeably smooth. The trains were evidently a government-run monopoly, and somebody spent money on the roadbeds. A conductor took his ticket with a smile, doubtless marking Jack as a Yank instantly, and moved on, leaving Ryan to his paper. The passing scenery soon overtook his interest. The countryside was green and lush. The Brits did love their lawns. The row houses here were smaller than those in his childhood neighborhood in Baltimore, with what looked like slate roofs. And Jesus, the streets were narrow here. You'd really have to pay attention while driving, lest you end up in someone's living room. That probably wouldn't sit well, even to Englishmen accustomed to dealing with the shortcomings of visiting Yanks. It was a clear day, some white, fluffy clouds aloft, and the sky a delightful blue. He'd never experienced rain over here. Yet they had to have it. Every third man on the street carried a furled umbrella, and a lot of them wore hats. Ryan hadn't done that since his time in the Marine Corps. England was just different enough from America to be dangerous, he decided. There were a lot of similarities, but the differences rose up and bit you on the ass when you least expected them. He'd have to be very careful with Sally crossing the street. At 4 1/2, she was just imprinted enough to look the wrong way at the wrong time. He'd seen his little girl in the hospital once, and that was, by God, enough for a lifetime. He was rumbling through a city now, a thick one. The right-of-way was elevated. He looked around for recognizable landmarks. Was that St. Paul's Cathedral off to the right? If so, he'd be at Victoria soon. He folded his paper. Then the train slowed and... yeah. Victoria Station. He opened the compartment door like a native and stepped out on the platform. The station was a series of steel arches with embedded glass panes, long since blackened by the stack gases of steam trains long departed. But nobody had ever cleaned the glass. Or was it just air pollution that did it? There was no telling. Jack followed the rest of the people to the brick wall that seemed to mark the station's waiting arrival area. Sure enough, there were the usual collection of magazine stands and small stores. He could see the way out and found himself in the open air, fumbling in his pocket for his Chichester map of London. Westminster Bridge Road. It was too far to walk, so he hailed a cab. From the cab, Ryan looked around, his head swiveling, just like the tourist he wasn't quite anymore. And there it was. Century House, so named because it was 100 Westminster Bridge Road, was what Jack took to be a typical interwar structure of fair height and a stone facade that was peeling off? The edifice was covered with an orange plastic netting that was manifestly intended to keep the facade from falling onto pedestrians. Oops. Maybe somebody was ripping through the building, looking for Russian bugs. Nobody had warned him about that at Langley. Just up the road was Westminster Bridge, and across that were the Houses of Parliament. Well, it was in a nice neighborhood, anyway. Jack trotted up the stone steps to the double door and made his way inside for all of 10 feet, where he found an entry control desk manned by someone in a sort of cop uniform. "Can I help you, sir?" the guard asked. The Brits always said such things as though they really wanted to help you. Jack wondered if there might be a pistol just out of view. If not there, then not too far away. There had to be security here. "Hi, I'm Jack Ryan. I'm starting work here." Instant smile and recognition. "Ah, Sir John. Welcome to Century House. Please, let me call upstairs." Which he did. "Someone's on his way down, sir. Please have a seat." Jack barely had a chance to feel the seat when someone familiar came through the revolving door. "Jack," he called out.
"Sir Basil."
Ryan rose to take his extended hand.
"Didn't expect you until tomorrow."
"I'm letting Kathy get everything unpacked. She doesn't trust me to do it anyway."
"Yes, we men do have our limitations, don't we?"
Sir Basil Charleston was pushing 50, tall and imperially thin, as the poet had once called it, with brown hair not yet going gray. His eyes were hazel and bright-looking, and he wore a suit that wasn't cheap, gray wool with a broad white pinstripe, looking to all the world like a very prosperous London merchant banker. In fact, his family had been in that line of work, but he'd found it confining and opted instead to use his Cambridge education in the service of his country, first as a field intelligence officer and later as an administrator. Jack knew that James Greer liked and respected him, as did Judge Moore. He'd met Charleston himself a year earlier, soon after being shot. Then he'd learned that Sir Basil admired his invention of the canary trap, which had been his path to high-level notice at Langley. Basil had evidently used it to plug a few annoying leaks.
"Come along, Jack. We need to get you properly outfitted."
He didn't mean Jack's suit, which was Savile Row and as expensive as his own. No, this meant a trip to personnel. The presence of C, as the job title went, made it painless. They already had a set of Ryan's fingerprints from Langley, and it was mainly a matter of getting his picture taken and inserted in his pass card, which would allow him through all the electronic gates, just like the ones at the CIA. They checked it through a dummy gate and saw that it worked. Then it was up in the executive elevator to Sir Basil's capacious corner office. It was better than the long, narrow room that Judge Moore made do with. A decent view of the river and the Palace of Westminster. The DG waved Jack into a leather chair. "So, any first impressions?" Charleston asked. "Pretty painless so far. Kathy hasn't been to the hospital yet, but Bernie, her boss at Hopkins, says that the boss doc there is a good guy." "Yes, Hammersmith has a good reputation, and Dr. Bird is regarded as the best eye surgeon in Britain. Never met him, but I'm told he's a fine chap. Fisherman. Loves to take salmon out of the rivers in Scotland. Married, 3 sons, eldest is a lieutenant in the Coldstream Guards."
"You had him checked out?" Jack asked incredulously.
"One cannot be too careful, Jack. Some of your distant cousins across the Irish Sea are not overly fond of you, you know."
"Is that a problem?"
Charleston shook his head.
"Most unlikely.
When you helped to bring down the ULA, you probably saved a few lives in the PIRA. That's still sorting itself out, but that is mainly a job for the security service. We don't really have much business with them. At least nothing that will concern you directly."
Which led to Jack's next question.
"Yes, Sir Basil. What exactly is my job to be here?"
"Didn't James tell you?" Charleston asked.
"Not exactly. He likes his surprises, I've learned."
"Well, the joint working group mainly focuses on our Soviet friends. We have some good sources. So do your chaps. The idea is to share information in order to improve our overall picture."
"Information, not sources," Ryan observed. Charleston smiled understandingly.
"One must protect those, as you know."
Jack did know about that. In fact, he was allowed to know damned little about CIA's sources. Those were the most closely guarded secrets in the agency, and doubtless here as well. Sources were real people, and a slip of the tongue would get them killed. Intelligence services valued its sources more for their information than for their lives. The intelligence business was a business, after all. But sooner or later you started worrying about them and their families and their personal characteristics. Mainly booze, Ryan thought, especially for the Russians. The ordinary Soviet citizen drank enough to qualify him as an alcoholic in America.
"No problem there, sir. I do not know the name or identity of one CIA source over there."
"Not one," Ryan emphasized. It wasn't quite true. He hadn't been told, but you could guess a lot from the character of the information transmitted, and the way he/she quoted people. They were usually he, but Ryan wondered about a few of the sources. It was an intriguing game that all analysts played, invariably in the confines of their own minds, though Ryan had speculated a few times with his personal boss, Admiral Jim Greer. Usually the DDO had warned him not to speculate too loudly, but the way he'd blinked twice had told Ryan more than he'd wanted to convey. Well, they'd hired him for his analytical ability, Ryan knew. He didn't really want him to turn it off. When the information transmitted got a little kinky, it told you that something had happened to the source, like being caught or going nuts. "The Admiral is interested in one thing, though."
"What's that?" the DG asked.
"Poland. It looks to us as though it's coming a little unglued, and we're wondering how far, how fast, and what it'll do. The effects, I mean.
So are we, Jack.
A thoughtful nod. People, especially reporters in their Fleet Street pubs, were speculating a lot about that. And reporters also had good sources, in some areas as good as his own.
What does James think?
It reminds both of us of something that happened in the 1930s. Ryan leaned back in the chair and relaxed. The United Auto Workers? When they organized Ford, there was trouble. Big time. Ford even hired thugs to work the union organizers over. I remember seeing photos of... Who was it? Jack paused for a moment's thought. Walter Reuther? Something like that. It was in Life magazine back then. The thugs were talking to him and a few of his guys. The first few pictures show them smiling at each other like men do right before the gloves come off. And then a brawl started. You have to wonder about Ford's management. Letting something like that happen in front of reporters is bad enough. But reporters with cameras? Damn, that's big league dumb.
The court of public opinion.
Yes, Charleston agreed.
It is quite real, and modern technology has made it even more so, and yes, that is troubling to our friends across the wire. You know, this CNN news network that just started up on your side of the ocean, it just might change the world. Information has its own way of circulating. Rumors are bad enough. You cannot stop them, and they have a way of acquiring a life of their own.
But a picture really is worth a thousand words, isn't it?
I wonder who first said that.
Whoever he was no one's fool. It's even more true for a moving picture. I presume we're using that.
Your chaps are reticent about doing so. I am less so. It's easy enough to have an embassy functionary have a pint with some reporter and maybe drop the odd hint in the course of a conversation. One thing about reporters, they are not ungracious if you give them the odd, decent story.
At Langley, they hate the press, Sir Basil. And I do mean hate.
Rather backward of them. But then we can exercise more control over the press here than you can in America, I suppose.
Still and all, it's not that hard to outsmart them, is it?
I've never tried. Admiral Greer says that talking to a reporter is like dancing with a Rottweiler. You can't be sure if he's going to lick your face or rip your throat out.
They're not bad dogs at all, you know. You just need to train them properly.
Brits and their dogs, Ryan reflected. They like their pets more than their kids.
He didn't care for big dogs all that much.
A Labrador like Ernie was different. Labs had a soft mouth.
Sally really missed him.
So, what's your take on Poland, Jack?
I think the pot's going to simmer until the lid slides off, and then when it boils over, there's going to be a hell of a mess. The Poles haven't really bought into communism all that well. Their army has chaplains, for Christ's sake. A lot of their farmers operate on a free agent basis, selling hams and stuff. The most popular TV show over there is Kojak. They even show it on Sunday morning to draw people away from going to church. That shows two things. The people there like American culture, and the government is still afraid of the Catholic Church. The Polish government is unstable, and they know they're unstable. Allowing a little wiggle room is probably smart, at least in the short term. But the fundamental problem is that they operate a fundamentally unjust regime. Unjust countries are not stable, sir. However strong they appear, they're rotten underneath.
Charleston nodded thoughtfully. I briefed the PM just 3 days ago out at Chequers and told her much the same thing.
The Director General paused for a moment, then decided. He lifted a file folder from the pile on his desk and handed it across. The cover read, "Most Secret." So, Jack thought, now it starts. He wondered if Basil had learned to swim by falling into the Thames, and thought everyone should learn the same way. Flipping the cover open, he saw that this information came from a source called Wren. He was clearly Polish and, by the look of the report, well-placed. And what he said... "Damn," Ryan observed. "This is reliable?" "Very much so. It's a 5-5, Jack." By that, he meant that the source was rated 5 on a scale of 5 for reliability, and the importance of the information reported was graded the same way. "You're Catholic, I think?" He knew, of course. It was just the English way of talking. "Jesuits at high school, Boston College, and Georgetown, plus the nuns at St. Matthew's. I'd better be." "What do you think of your new pope?" "First non-Italian in 4 centuries, maybe more." "That's saying something right there. When I heard the new one was Polish, I expected it to be Cardinal Wyszynski from Warsaw. Guy's got the brains of a genius and the cunning of a fox. This guy I didn't know beans about, but from what I've read since, he's a very solid citizen. Good parish priest, good administrator, politically very astute." Ryan paused. He was discussing the head of his church as though he were a political candidate, and he was damn sure there was more substance to him than that. This had to be a man of deep faith, with a sort of core convictions that an earthquake couldn't budge or crack. He'd been chosen by other such men to be the leader and spokesman for the world's largest church, which, by the way, also happened to be Ryan's church. He'd be a man who didn't fear much of anything. A man for whom a bullet was his get-out-of-jail-free card, a key to God's own presence. And he'd be a man who felt God's presence in everything he did. He was not someone you could scare. Not someone you could turn away from what he deemed the right thing. "If he wrote this letter, Sir Basil, it's not a bluff." "When was it delivered?" "Less than 4 days ago. Our chap broke a rule getting it to us so quickly, but its importance is patently clear, is it not?" "Welcome to London, Jack," Ryan thought. He'd just fallen into the soup. A big pot, like they used to boil missionaries in the cartoons. "Okay, it's been forwarded to Moscow, right?" "So our chap tells us." "So, Sir John, what will Ivan have to say about this?" And with that question, Sir Basil Charleston lit the fire under Jack's personal cauldron. "That's a multifaceted question," Ryan said, dodging as artfully as the situation allowed. "It wasn't very far." "He will say something," Charleston observed, leveling his hazel eyes at Ryan. "Okay. They won't like it. They will see it as a threat. The question is how seriously they will take it and how much credence they will attach to it. Stalin might have laughed it off. Or maybe not. Stalin defined paranoia, didn't he?" Ryan paused and looked out the windows. "Was that a rain cloud blowing in?" "No, Stalin would have acted somehow."
"Think so?"
Charleston was evaluating him, Jack knew. This was like the orals for his doctorate at Georgetown. Father Tim Riley's rapier wit and needlepoint questions. Sir Basil was more civilized than the acerbic priest, but this exam was not going to be an easy one. Leon Trotsky was no threat to him. That assassination came from a combination of paranoia and pure meanness. It was a personal thing. Stalin made enemies, and he never forgot them. But the current Soviet leadership doesn't have the guts to do the stuff he did. Charleston pointed out the plate-glass window toward Westminster Bridge. My lad, the Russians had the intestinal fortitude to kill a man right on that bridge less than 5 years ago. And got caught for it, Ryan reminded his host. It had been a combination of good luck and a very smart British doctor.